Yeah, it's very eerie. It's very eerie. I guess like a lot of other sites, you know, just the kind of eerie normalcy that people return to at the site of a horrific murder.
Kim Kompok is part of the Justice for Colin Eldredge Coalition. We're outside the Waikiki McDonald's, where State Department agent Christopher Didi shot and killed Eldredge in 2011.
How would you describe this for someone who's not here with us today? Like what it feels like to be standing here and what you're looking at?
Probably some people would consider this a mini McDonald's. It's pretty small. Maybe the smallness contributes to a sense of innocence or something. We're just this little place. Nothing big's going to happen here, you know, when really someone was murdered here. A whole family's hearts were broken here. And a very young person died here.
I was surprised at how small it seems. Like in the videos, you feel like it looks like a much bigger place. And it's really tiny.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I was thinking about the tourists, you know, and what do they know about this site, you know? Would they feel differently about patronizing this spot? It kind of makes me angry that it looks so normal. You know, I want there to be some recognition about this as a site of murder and not just as a place that people get burgers and going back to business as usual. Because it wasn't business as usual, you know, not for this community, not for the family. Should there really be anything here but a memorial?
I'm Jessica Terrell. From Honolulu Civil Beat and PRX, this is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. This is episode 8 of our first season, A Killing in Waikiki. If you haven't heard the other episodes, go check them out first. You'll want to know more about Special Agent Christopher Didi and Colin Eldredge, the Native Hawaiian man Didi killed, and a decades-old crime story that many people in Hawaii connected to Eldredge's death, the 1932 Massey case and the murder of Joseph Ka'avai. After the trials are over, after justice is dispensed with or justice is denied, at some point the world moves on. McDonald's workers transfer to other restaurants, away from a workplace with such gruesome memories. Attorneys start working on other cases. Newspapers lose interest. Memories fade. An eerie normalcy returns. But for people at the center of such high-profile cases, for the families of both the victims and the shooters, nothing is ever really normal again. Not even decades later. Benjalin Queenie Kavako is a Native Hawaiian woman in her early 70s. Queenie, as she likes to be called, lives in a beautiful house on the west side of Oahu. It's the kind of home that just looks like it was built for big family gatherings. She invites me to sit on her back porch, which has this giant wood table with seats for at least a dozen people. Having people over all the time? That's the way her dad, Ben Ahakuelo, raised her.
Everybody knew the Ahakuelos, you were always welcome to come over. Anybody in the neighborhood that needed to eat or something, they were always welcome. That's the kind of house we had.
Ahakuelo was a quiet guy with a simple life. A hardworking fireman who liked to cook big meals, play the ukulele, spend time with his kids, grandkids. He was also a man with a secret. A protective father who managed to keep the horrors of his past hidden from his youngest daughter for decades.
Tell me about the newspaper article when you first read a story about the Massey case.
I was dumbfounded. You know, I thought they was talking about the wrong guy.
Queenie was in her 20s with kids of her own.
My neighbor, Uncle Boy Ely, he came walking over my house. He said, "Hey, Queenie, I think you better look at this." And I said, "Well, what's up, Uncle?" And he said, "Read this. This is about your dad." And I was stunned because I was thinking, you got to be wrong.
The article said her father was one of five men accused of raping a white woman named Thalia Massey in the 1930s. Did it also explain that her father's best friend had been murdered by Navy officers? She can't remember the details of the story, only that she was totally shocked.
I remember calling my mom and telling her, "Mom, what is this?" And she said, "You know what, baby? Come home. Dad's home." My dad was sitting down and he wasn't smiling. And he wasn't happy because my mom said, "Hey, it's time. You got to tell your kids." And it was only me. He just had tears in his eyes and said that He never wanted that to touch us. And he was sad that it did. You know, because he was hoping that that would never come up ever again.
Queenie's dad, he wanted what happened to him in his 20s, what happened to his friend Kaavai, to be pow. That's the Hawaiian word for finished, over, done with.
He said, pow, pow. But it wasn't pow, and that's the reason why it came up, because it was about history. He just said that, you know, they did nothing wrong, and he didn't want it to touch his family.
He felt back then there was so much hurt, so much people that they love that got hurt, and so he just didn't want that hurt to be to his children. Now I understand, but at first I thought, well, that was a long time ago. Who cares? But, you know, he did.
Although Ahakuelo tried to shield his family from his past, he was actually more vocal than any of the other accused men in the rape case. He gave a few interviews later in life. The other men, they went on to suffer through tough lives in mostly silence. David Stannard, who wrote the book Honor Killing about the Massey case, he says a lot of people either thought the men were guilty or felt the whole story put a stain on Hawaii. Better to try and pretend it didn't happen.
They were not guilty, but there's always a lingering taint. There's always something that sticks to you from those kind of accusations.
After Kaavai's killers sailed back to the mainland, the famous Pinkerton Agency led an extensive investigation into the rape case. And in the end, they totally exonerated the men of any wrongdoing. But the Pinkerton report, it was buried for decades.
Nobody wanted that released because it showed a gross miscarriage of justice that resulted in the murder of a young man.
Queenie thinks maybe there's another reason her dad never spoke much about what happened. That's just the way things were back in the day. Neither of her parents were big talkers. Silence had been drilled into Hawaiians after the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom.
My parents, way back then, you know, the Hawaiians, they were restricted from speaking their language. And I never knew that my mother could speak Hawaiian fluently because she never did. You know, maybe she would say something simple like, eh, a'ole pilikia, which means cut that out. And then one day, there was a friend that came over and two of them was going for broke talking Hawaiian.
It was a total shock for Queenie to learn that her mom was fluent in Hawaiian, to see how different her mother seemed when she was speaking in her native tongue.
Back then, they were scared to speak, so they never talked about things. It just became like, okay, you can't speak your language, so you just don't talk at all, so you stay out of trouble. So they never did really tell us stories.
Did what happened to Ahakuelo impact the way he felt about people, the way he raised his children?
No, except the fact that, you know, everything was, like I said, you know, the way he raised us was either right or wrong. I'm sure that came from the case. You right or wrong, there's no gray. So the big thing was, do not lie. Tell the truth. Yeah, that was a big thing in our home.
And she says, reflecting on it so many years later, maybe it explains why he was always so protective of his kids, of her.
It really made him aware, you know, like to protect his family. Even to the last day he died, everything was protect, protect, protect. Not trusting, you know.
When Tommy and Thalia Massey boarded a cruise ship to leave Hawaii in 1932, they seemed to be pretty trusting that life would turn out swell. The Howley couple at the center of the Massey case, they were greeted as returning heroes by whites in the U.S. For many people, especially in the South, killing a Hawaiian man wasn't seen as a sin. It was a vindication of white honor. The Masseys went on a celebrity tour. Thalia Massey's mother even made money for a while selling her story. And Tommy Massey, he went right back to his job on a submarine.
This is a man who has participated in a murder.
That's DeSoto Brown, a historian at the Bishop Museum.
And what's happened to him? Has he been disciplined in the Navy? No. He goes back to his regular duties as a naval officer. Now, that's also shocking, too, that nothing serious happened to him. He had no repercussions in the U.S. military for killing a man.
The Masseys, their marriage continued to disintegrate, though. They got divorced 2 years after they left Hawaii. And Thalia, she was a wreck.
Not too long afterwards, she went on an ocean cruise to Europe, and she tried to kill herself. and she cut her wrists. And this is a photograph of her sitting on the deck of the ship before she cut her wrists, because she continued to be the subject of publicity, obviously.
When was that photo taken? Because she looks like she's aged 20 years.
So this is in April of 1934. So it's about 2 years after the Massey case.
Wow, that's unbelievable. Her hair is disheveled. Her teeth don't look great. Her face is kind of puffy. I mean, she looks like a much, much older woman. Well, certainly much older than 22. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. She didn't escape publicity for a time. And the caption of this picture of her with her sister, "With all thoughts of suicide out of her mind and happy to be home alive, Mrs. Thalia Fortescue Massey, divorced wife of Lieutenant Thomas Massey, returned to New York from a rest cure in Italy."
Thalia Massey's mother, she appears to be the only one who walked away unscathed. She eventually inherited the bulk of her father's fortune and outlived not only her daughter, but all the other participants in Kaavai's murder. She died at the age of 95. The Navy eventually figured out that Tommy Massey didn't belong in an officer's uniform. He was hospitalized in 1940 for psychiatric issues and then forced into retirement by the Navy Medical Board. Thalia Massey never remarried, and after multiple suicide attempts, she overdosed on sedatives in 1963.
She didn't have a happy life. I mean, she eventually did kill herself.
It's hard to feel any real sympathy for the Masseys. People who seem so villainous that it's easier to think of them as caricatures than as thinking, feeling human beings. When I think about Christopher Didi and Colin Eldertz, when I turn on the news these days and see the constant and heartbreaking coverage of police shootings on the mainland, I keep coming back to this. What does it really mean to be the person on the other side of the gun? What does it feel like to know you've killed another human being? Even when it's in self-defense, when you're sure you did the right thing, even when you're certain you had no other choice, what does it really mean to take someone's life? I'm never going to get to ask Christopher Didi those questions. His lawyers have been pretty clear from the beginning that there's no way he's going to talk as long as his case is pending. So I turn to this guy, David Klinger, instead.
I think the first thing that people need to understand is there's a range of reactions.
Klinger is a professor at the University of Missouri-St. Louis, a use of force expert who's interviewed dozens of cops involved in fatal shootings. He's also a former cop who shot and killed someone in the line of duty.
Some officers literally have no negative reaction whatsoever, and in fact, some are ebullient in the wake of a shooting, not because they killed somebody, but because they survived and they were alive.
Other officers, Klinger said, are devastated.
And I interviewed two officers in particular who contemplated suicide over having taken a life.
Klinger's reaction, it was probably somewhere in between.
Being presented with a situation where I had to take someone's life was a shock and went against my religious catechism. I made an initial peace with it fairly early on that this is what had to happen, but there was still a residual, and that residual basically took almost two decades to finally work itself out.
Klinger was a 23-year-old rookie with the Los Angeles Police Department the night he shot and killed a man named Edward Randolph.
I'm working South Central Los Angeles with a guy by the name of Dennis Acevedo. We responded to a call to back up officers in a neighboring division where apparently there was an individual holed up with a gun and he'd already fired at least one shot at the homeowner.
Klinger and his partner were told to set up a perimeter around the house. Most people had left the area, but there was one guy across the street who wasn't moving. They yelled at him to leave, but he wouldn't. So while Klinger's crouched down, gun drawn, his partner goes over to talk to the guy. Klinger is concentrating on the house, trying to make sure that the gunman inside doesn't shoot his partner. Suddenly, he hears screaming, and he turns around to see the man across the street stabbing his partner in the chest with a butcher knife.
As I'm running, Dennis trips and falls. And so by the time I get there a few seconds later, Dennis is on his back. The suspect has jumped on top of him and is trying to drive the knife through his throat, but Dennis has grabbed the suspect's wrist.
People react to fear differently, to adrenaline. Klinger says he felt an almost clinical detachment in that moment. His partner is yelling, "Shoot!" And at first, Klinger's trying to figure out if there's anything he can do to not shoot the guy with the knife. And then how he can shoot him without hitting his partner.
I pulled the trigger once, and just before the suspect says, "Oh shit," I remember thinking in my mind, that was odd because when I pulled the trigger, I was expecting to hear a big boom because gunfire, when you don't have ear protection, is loud, and it was very muted, almost like a pop gun or a cap gun.
Klinger gets the man off his partner. Paramedics arrive.
They cut the suspect's clothes off, and I watched him bleed to death probably a minute or two later.
Klinger didn't feel much at first.
Yeah, I think initially it was empty and sort of numb. I knew exactly what I had done, but we were still in the moment. And then once we got back to the station, now it's concern about the investigation. It's concern that perhaps someone is going to say that I did something wrong. I could get fired. I could get indicted.
At home that night, Klinger says he was still in shock. He called his pastor, his family members. He can't remember what he said to them.
The first actual emotion that I remember feeling independent of the event was anger, because the next day in the press, the headline reads in one of the LA papers, "Police officer shoots spectator at barricaded scene." And I'm scratching my head going, why in the world would you frame it that way? It is a true statement that he was a spectator, but he also moved from being a spectator to someone who's trying to murder a cop. So anger that someone else was going to label and define what I was involved in a very negative fashion. The sadness starts to creep in as I start to think about why I went into police work and that my vision of what I was going to be able to do isn't going to come to fruition. The reason that I went into law enforcement in the first place wasn't to shoot people, but to help people. I think also a notion of loss of innocence, that not only are there bad things that happen in the world, but I have been now completely enveloped in one of these things. And my sense of being able to always talk people out of things, always being able to be the peacemaker that I was called to be, that's out the window. And so sadness over that. And then just anger about the state of the world. You know, why is the world so screwed up?
I mean, obviously, you probably knew the man's name at some point. Did you think of him over the coming years? Did you ever want to find out more about him? Or were you able to sort of create like a separating line where that was the incident and I'm just going to leave that in the past?
I was told that he was an ex-con from Texas and that he had told his friends and relatives that the next police that fucked with him, he was going to murder him. So I never looked at him as someone who I really needed to know anything more about beyond that. That said, he was a human being, and that was part of the pain and the anger that I felt. He was a human being, period.
I would imagine trying to understand what Chris Verdidi's going through, that however you feel about the shooting, there must be a lot of stress that happens to your life from having your actions questioned and so publicly questioned and lived and relived. Is that something at all that you've looked at or talked about with officers?
I can tell you that when I got the letter from the Los Angeles County District Attorney saying that their case was closed, there would be no prosecution, it was a huge relief. That is a sentiment that many, many officers have shared with me. And then for those officers who got sued, there was a great deal of anger that, you know, they did what was right and now someone is suing them. Of course, having your freedom taken away potentially would be stressful. And also the mere fact that people are claiming that you are a criminal, which is, after all, what a criminal indictment is, that in and of itself, moving the label from I'm a good guy or a good gal to a bad guy or a bad gal has got to be incredibly stressful.
Nobody goes into law enforcement and gets issued a firearm, assuming they'll never have to use it. That's what Klinger says. But that doesn't mean officers don't hope they'll never have to fire their weapon.
And it was like time stood still. We stood there. I was in fear for Adam's life. I was in fear for my life.
That's Christopher Didi on the stand, talking about the moment before he killed Colin Eldertz in 2011.
I was on the brink of making a decision whether or not to use deadly force. As a law enforcement officer, this is a moment I've dreaded from the start of my career. Once you make that decision and you pull the trigger, you can't ever go back. I made an oath to serve and protect. I And that's what I did.
Does Christopher Didi feel sadness about what happened that night? Relief? Anger? Guilt? Whatever Didi feels about Colin Eldertz, it's safe to say he's been under a lot of stress for the last 5 years. Didi's been put on trial twice, and even though a jury found him not guilty of murder, he's still facing a possible third criminal trial. Once the criminal trials are over with, there's a pending civil case filed by the Eldertz family. In some ways, Didi has managed to carry on with a normal life, even with the threat of imprisonment hanging over him. He's still employed by the State Department, though he's not allowed to carry a weapon and has been essentially assigned to desk duty while his case is still pending. The department either hasn't completed or is simply refusing to release at this point the internal investigation into his conduct. We know from court records that even when his bail conditions were the most restrictive, he managed to make time to visit his elderly grandmother in Florida, get away for the holidays, attend a wedding with his wife. He even got out on a surfboard at least once in Waikiki. On the other hand, much of his life appears to have been frozen since 2011. Once you pull the trigger, you can't go back. That's what Didi said. While some law enforcement groups have rallied behind him, other groups have distanced themselves. Organizations that he used to play an active leadership and fundraising role in have all but erased him from their website history. Not that he's had much spare time for volunteering. Preparing his defense became something of a second full-time job, according to a website started by his friends to rally support for the special agent. His outlet for all that stress? Exercise. Didi runs the website for a CrossFit exercise group for State Department agents. In his CrossFit profile, he describes his experience with the program as life-changing. The mentions of Didi online in the last few years that don't involve his criminal trials are about exercise. Videos of his workout routines, photos of CrossFit meets. And whatever peace he's made with what happened, whether like some officers Klinger interviewed, he feels like he was just doing his job in McDonald's that night, or whether like others, he suffers from depression and anxiety, we can know for sure it's something he spent a lot of time thinking about. Here's Didi on the stand again in 2013.
I would watch this video hundreds, if not more, times. I see it when I close my eyes, and when I try to sleep in it, I see the event again over and over again. I never stop seeing it.
Reliving Colin Eldert's death over and over and over again, watching the video of the confrontation frame by frame. That's what the Eldert's family had to do during Didi's trials. And Kalama Naheyu says it pretty much destroyed them.
Well, I think the first thing to realize is that his family before was completely different from his family after. They never recovered. They still haven't recovered.
That's Naheyu, the family friend who acts as their spokesperson.
During the trial, they bring out his bloodied clothes, and the whole family just recoils because here they are, 2 feet away from their son's completely blood-soaked clothes. The last time that they was seen wearing them, he was alive.
The whole family was there during the first trial, every day. People lost their jobs to be there, emptied savings accounts. But they did it because they were certain they were going to get justice, Naheyu said.
They believed fully in the American system. They believed that because they've always paid their taxes and they've gone to school and they did all the good things that you're supposed to do, they believed that justice would happen.
Adding to the family's strain,
the family has death notes sent to their house. People send them messages. Your son deserved to die. What kind of person are you? What human being are you? You know, I hope somebody kills everyone in your family.
And it's not just the personal attacks that have wounded the family. It's turning on the news and watching people speculate about Eldert's character, picking apart tiny details of his life to paint a picture of someone not deserving of empathy.
His family said that Colin was killed twice. He was killed once in the McDonald's, and then he was killed a second time in the media.
After the jury hung in the first trial, family members went into survival mode.
Before, they were firmly, you know, kind of middle class. They were doing okay. Both employed, they had good jobs, had money in the bank, they had retirement. All of their savings are gone. All of their resources are gone. So you went from a very stable family to living very precariously, financially.
Nehiu says Hawaiian or Kanaka Maoli culture is often perceived as being boisterous. But that image misses a lot.
Part of our culture is we have people who are very, like, they go very internal when bad things happen, and they retreat. So the entire family really retreated and went, in particular, his father and his second mother, is what I call Janelle, they went into a deep depression. And it was a profound trauma. And I don't think that they've recovered.
And well, if what happened in the Massey case was impacting Ahakuelo and his family 40 years later, you can only imagine how much the Eldert's family is still struggling. The way time passes differently when you're in the depths of such grief. The days that you expect to hurt badly. Birthdays. Anniversaries. And then the random moments. Like August 5th, 2012. The day Colin Eldert's stepmom posted on Facebook about a different mile marker that had passed since Eldert's death. 9 months, she said. Long enough to conceive and birth a new life. You are in our thoughts and prayers every day. 5 years later, Colin Eldert's dad, Kendall, still has a hard time making it through the day, Nehiu says.
He doesn't, like, fall down and cry. It just becomes nonverbal. He just closes up.
Even family gatherings became painful.
The family kind of scattered. The brothers looked very similar to each other. And when they would get together, they could see Colin and each other, and it was almost unbearable for them.
I've seen photos of the family, and it's true. With a few of his brothers, the resemblance is uncanny. Eldert's and his dad, Kendall, they used to go fishing together a lot. Gather opihi, a kind of shellfish.
There was a long time that Kendall couldn't do that.
There was a small sign of healing for the family earlier this year, out on the water.
For the first time, Kendall and several of his brothers actually went out and they gathered opihi together. And, you know, them being the Kanakas that they are, you know, it's like, they didn't know, like, this is for Colin, you know. But it was for Colin. It was the first time that they had actually gotten together. And for a long time, they couldn't do it because Colin wasn't there.
Is there a part of them that at this point just sort of wants it to go away? I mean, I can't imagine how difficult it would be to go through a third trial. Obviously, you still want that conviction. But mm-hmm. at this point, is there a part of them that also just wants to be done?
When I've talked to them, the only way that they can survive day to day is to have an absolute faith that the conviction will happen. I don't know what's going to happen if he does go free. I don't think they ever contemplated stopping.
This is Offshore, Stories from Hawaii. I'm Jessica Terrell. We started out this season asking a lot of questions about Hawaii, about this case, about whether Christopher Didi should be in jail or whether he's being scapegoated because of Hawaii's long history of white racism and federal intervention, about whether Hawaii can offer any hope for the mainland. What answers have we been able to find? That's next week on Offshore. Subscribe now and tell your friends. You don't want to miss it. Offshore is produced by Honolulu Civil Beat, a member-supported nonprofit news organization dedicated to covering the real Hawaii. Donate to support this podcast and our journalism at civilbeat.org. Offshore is distributed by PRX. Offshore's producer and executive producer is Ben Adair. Our editor is Patty Epler. April Estrelon's our associate producer. I'll be back next week.